Thank you very much, Alex. Okay, it's welcome to everyone from me as well. Astronomers, I guess, are fairly nocturnal creatures, so it does feel a bit strange for me doing 10 o'clock on a Saturday morning rather than for days as usually my custom, 7:30 p.m. of an evening. And I recognise a few faces from either this year's or previous year's evening classes, so you're most welcome. And hopefully I'm not going to repeat too much from anything you've heard me talk about in those classes before, because this is a bit of a departure from the kind of material I would normally cover. I'm doing very much the historical end of things and also a bit of scene setting that's appropriate for people that maybe are coming to this without too much prior experience of this theme or astronomy classes in general. I know that certainly doesn't apply to all of you, but there might be some for whom this is relatively new. So the title, Captain Cook and the Cosmic Yardstick, sort of comes about from a series of schools lectures and public lectures which I put together in 2003 and early 2004, and I was looking at historical events that took place in the late 18th century and indeed before that, because there was a very significant event that happened in 2004, which was a transit of Venus. So the purpose of my talk is to tell you a bit about that transit, the one which Captain Cook and his colleagues observed, to tell you a bit about the transit in 2004, and also to give you some background as to what the significance of transits are, transits of Venus in particular, and other transits. And that will link in to the final talk of the day, because although we're not terribly concerned as professional astronomers about transits these days, they're fascinating events nonetheless and have captured a lot of media attention, transits of Venus and Mercury in our own solar system are kind of old hat. But what's much more of interest these days is observing transits of planets around other stars, and it's one of the key tools we now have for finding planets around other stars. Now, I'm not going to tell you anything about that, but I'm just giving you a trailer for what Helen Fraser will cover in the final talk of the day, and Helen's on her way back from Edinburgh, I believe, at the moment, so she probably won't join us until later in the morning. But she will link back again to that theme of transits, and then the two talks kind of in the middle are going to focus more on the eclipse side of things. First of all, Lindsay will tell us a bit about the Sun and the kind of interesting astronomical and physical questions we can learn about the Sun, and then Bonnie Steeves after lunch will develop further that theme of eclipses. So anyhow, why should I be interested in Captain Cook? Well, apart from the fact that he's a very fascinating historical character anyway, the particular reason why I get interested in this topic is all to do with an image that I guess those who have come to some of my evening days classes will be more familiar with. Much more up to date than Captain Cook. This is the Hubble Space Telescope from the time it was launched in April 1990. And I, for many years thereafter, was involved in a project using the Hubble Space Telescope to observe distant galaxies and measure their distances. Galaxies like the ones you see here, beautiful spirals, some of the most beautiful Hubble images come from this project, and spiral galaxies very much like our own Milky Way. But what we have remarkably been able to do over many decades is to devise methods to accurately determine distances to galaxies like those, and therefore to use that information to work out the scale of the whole universe. Very grand program of work, and indeed it didn't really start out quite so well, because back in the early 1900s, Edwin Hubble, after whom the Space Telescope was subsequently named, was the pioneer in this field, but he basically kind of got his sums wrong. He worked out a scale of the universe which, with the benefit of modern day measurements and calculations, was shown subsequently to be seriously in error. But he still had the principle of the method right, that since one can't, after all, just take a big ruler and measure the distance to a distant galaxy, what you have to do instead is to devise some indirect methods to make the measurements. And the Hubble Space Telescope project to measure distances to galaxies like these began in 1990, effectively ended in 2000, but the story goes on because these are fairly nearby galaxies, whereas much more distant ones, which I've been talking about in the extreme astrophysics class, have led us to the quite startling deduction that the universe is not only expanding, which is what Hubble told us, but moreover it appears to be speeding up. And that all hinges on observing very distant objects called supernovae, sort of artist's impression of one is shown here, an exploding star whose brightness is more or less constant. That means to say, well, the brightness of any single object is far from constant because it blows itself up. But as you consider lots of these supernovae, the brightness of one of them is broadly similar to the brightness of others. And that allows one to sort of make all sorts of complicated deductions about whether the universe is speeding up or slowing down. Now, I'm not going to talk about that this morning, but that's just by way of letting you see the kind of context in which I've had an interest for a long time in measuring the scale of the universe. That's how we do it nowadays, and it's led us to these startling deductions about dark energy and various other terms that you may have heard in the media. But of course that whole process has to start somewhere. If you're going to measure the distance to distant supernovae, you first of all got to know how far away much nearer objects are. You've got to be able to build up a kind of ladder, a distance scale, based on first of all knowing the scale of the solar system, knowing the distance to nearby stars, knowing the size of our Milky Way galaxy, knowing the distance to nearby galaxies, and then finally perhaps using these distant supernovae to answer these big questions about whether the universe is speeding up or slowing down. So the remainder of my talk is going to be firmly rooted in the history of this subject up to and including the voyages of Captain Cook. But it's just worth bearing in mind that the kind of profound questions we're now tackling about the size and scale of the universe were equally profound back then, but the scale involved was, you know, how big is our solar system and how big is our galaxy? Those were challenging enough for earlier centuries, and now we're just trying to build on that work to tackle questions on even larger scales. So really today what I want to talk about is the question of how we determine the size of our solar system, and that's where transits come in. So we'll learn, I hope, a bit about how that all works and some of the historical events that led to the first reliable determinations of the scale of our solar system. So the distance to the Sun is known as the astronomical unit, and that really is what this first presentation is about. It's about the quest to determine the value of the astronomical unit. How far away is the Sun? So our story begins much longer ago than that, perhaps, much longer ago than the time of Captain Cook, and really in prehistory. For many thousands of years, we are aware of cultures all around the world who have studied the heavens in great detail and who have knowledge of the motions of the planets. And what you see here is a little computer animation of the sky on a particular date. I believe, if I remember correctly, it was March 5th, 1999. And on that particular date, if you looked out towards the west after sunset, you could see the planet Mercury, Saturn, Venus, and Jupiter. They happen to be in that area of the sky. If you looked at the same patch of sky a year later, in March 2000, the planets were gone. Now, it's very hard to make out any of the stars. This is the sky close after twilight, where you wouldn't see many stars anyhow. You can maybe just see a few up there. And if I go back to the previous image, those stars are still there. But the planets have moved. And I guess if you've had an interest in astronomy through days or otherwise, I guess you'll be aware that planets, essentially their nature is to be wanderers. That's the Greek word planet means wanderer, against the background stars. It's the characteristic that made them stand out from the background stars to the ancient cultures of many thousands of years ago. So for a long time, therefore, we've known that the planet's motions were fundamentally different from the apparent motions of the stars. And to sort of illustrate that further, here's a little animation showing over the course of 1 year how the planet Mercury and Venus would move against this starry background. So you can see the Sun bobbing up and down. This is a view of the sky at midday, where we've conveniently switched off the daylight, so you can see the background stars as well. And you can see, of course, that the sun changes its altitude over the course of the year. In wintertime at midday, the sun is low in the sky. In summertime at midday, the sun is high in the sky. But for our purposes, the thing to really focus on is what Mercury and Venus are doing over the course of this little animation. It's running through a whole year, and yet you can see that throughout that time, we never lose sight of Mercury and Venus. They're always just bobbing back and forth either side of the sun as the sun changes its altitude, and also as the sun moves against background stars. We'll watch the movie one more time and you might recognise one or two of those constellations. The sun is moving through the constellations of the zodiac, and many of the zodiacal constellations are rather hard to spot. There's Taurus the Bull, there's Orion. The sun doesn't actually move through Orion, but nonetheless Orion's always easy to spot. That's visible in the winter skies, like this time of year, in the evening. So Mercury and Venus, in particular among the planets, perform this sort of merry dance either side of the sun. And of course, that's not true of all the planets, but there are other interesting characteristics of the other planets that we can briefly illustrate. Another movie, this time of Mars, and this is a simulation of what we would have seen with the benefit of clear skies, which of course we don't always get here in Glasgow, during the autumn of 2003, when Mars was about at its closest that it gets for a very, very long time, and it was rather bright in the sky. But in particular, what you could see if you watched Mars against those background stars for many weeks, you would see that, first of all, it would move to the right in my screen, but then it would kind of come to a standstill and then undergo a reverse motion, or a retrograde motion, as we call it. So it was doing a kind of celestial loop-the-loop on the sky. So long ago, thousands of years ago, before telescopes and before any development of astronomy in the modern sense where we study the intrinsic properties of the planets, ancient astronomers were still aware of these complicated motions that the planets displayed on the sky. And again, I'm sure for many of you here, this is a fairly familiar story, that to the Greeks, therefore, this presented a kind of challenge to try and explain those complex motions of the planets in the sky. And the ideas that they inherited really came out of Babylonia and Egypt, and they did approach astronomy in a vaguely scientific way. You know, they were quite systematic about making measurements of where the planets would appear in the sky, and indeed, in many ways, they established that there was a fundamental link between mathematics and explaining the motion of the planets in the sky, which is still just as firmly in place today as ever. You'll hear more about that from Bonnie, I'm sure, in the afternoon. But the Greeks didn't get it quite right, because they had the idea that all motions in the heavens had to be explainable in terms of circles, which was seen as the most perfect form of nature, and therefore celestial motions were combinations of circular motions. And I'm missing out a lot of the detail here, because it's, you know, otherwise we'll never get up to the 18th century and Captain Cook. But just to give you a sort of broad brush of some of the key ideas, well, in about the 4th century BC, we've got Aristotle, who put forward this idea that the universe was divided into the corrupt and changeable earth and the perfect and immutable heavens. So anything that was going up in the heavens belonged to the domain of perfect and immutable circles. And that was the sort of key idea that ran through the work of Claudius Ptolemy, famous astronomer who proposed a model that could explain these planetary motions, including those backward loops that we saw Mars doing in the little animation. And that's Ptolemy's diagram, you know, very ornate, but not perhaps particularly instructive, unless you can remember some Latin from high school. But there's the Earth in the middle, there's Moon, Mercury, Venus, and the Sun, then Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. And then outside of that is the sort of domain of the sphere of fixed stars, meaning that the view that the Greeks adopted was that the stars were in fact just attached to the sort of the vault of the heavens, and that was being turned around the Earth by agents unknown, effectively. But certainly this was long before the ideas of Newton about gravity and the like. But the key feature with regards to explaining the motion of the planets was to do with these nested circles. Now, what Ptolemy had to introduce in order to reproduce those retrograde loops, well, if Ptolemy had had PowerPoint and planetarium software, he might have showed something along these lines. So we see the Earth and Moon, with the Moon just performing a essentially circular orbit around the Earth, but the other planets, they perform these rather more elaborate orbits, including these loop-the-loop circles, so it looks a bit like a spirograph pattern. If we zoom out yet further, we can see Jupiter and Saturn doing roughly the same. So this is a geocentric view of the universe, keeping the Earth at the centre and looking at how the motions of the planets would appear from the Earth, which of course is the view that we get. So Ptolemy, without the benefit of PowerPoint, proposed a model whereby the planets moved along epicycles, those circles upon circles, which was a rather elaborate system, but nonetheless, broadly speaking, able to reproduce the apparent motion of the planets in these retrograde loops. And nigh on 1500 years later, that was essentially the view of the solar system, the view of the cosmos, that was firmly in place when Glasgow University opened its doors. And astronomy was taught here right from the word go, but nonetheless, the aspects of astronomy that were taught in 1451 that are common with how we teach it now would be very little, not quite so little as you might think, but at least the mathematics had many common elements, but the idea that the orbits were described by these epicycles has naturally fallen strongly out of fashion, but it was still firmly the view in 1451. Now this is a slightly later painting than that, but it's just to remind you that the location of the university originally used to be close to the High Street. There's the Tron Gate, the toll booth that you can see there. And as I said, there was some commonality between how astronomy was taught in 1451, the Ptolemaic model of the planets and how they moved, because the mathematics that could describe all that came from a textbook called The Sphere, which was published by a monk, John of Holywood, around 1200, lived in Oxford, and that was then the standard textbook on spherical trigonometry, and we still teach a lot of that sort of stuff nowadays, although we've updated our textbook at least since the 1200 edition from John Holywood. Again, just to fill in a few of the steps in what I'm sure for many of you is a very familiar story. As we know, along comes Nicholas Copernicus, and towards the end of his life he begins working on a different model. Now for some reason PowerPoint's inverted my image, but of course since the orbits are circular it doesn't make a great deal of difference, but that's the Sun in there, then we've got Mercury, Venus, and we've got the Earth and the Moon, and then the other planets. We've still got the sphere of fixed stars outside, but nonetheless the picture is fundamentally changed because now the Sun is at the centre. Now with regards to our story about transits and measuring the scale of the solar system, the key feature to take from Copernicus's model is now that there's an easier way to understand why Mercury and Venus appear close to the Sun in the sky, and in relation to this animation there's an easier way to understand why a planet like Mars will sometimes do its backwards loop-the-loop. It's because the Earth is overtaking Mars on the inside lane, you might say. Now I'm often thinking about this as I'm navigating my way around the four-lane Whirlies roundabout in East Kilbride. I'm not maybe something that's best advised to be thinking about Copernican models of the universe, but you can't fail to notice if you're on the inside lane that the traffic on the outside, it looks as if it's going backwards. Now, you know, you're reasonably confident that it's not, it's just that it's not going forwards as fast as you are, and that's the basic setup we have with the Earth overtaking Mars in its orbit. It will make Mars appear to do a retrograde loop, just like we saw in the previous animation. And as I said, this also provides a neat explanation of why Mercury and Venus always appear close to the Sun in the sky. Conversely, in the Ptolemaic model, then what one has to do is invoke sort of a rather ad hoc solution, just, you know, a rabbit out the hat in common terms, whereby the epicycles of Mercury and Venus somehow manage to always stay aligned to the line between the Earth and the Sun. This, in modern-day scientific theories, would be termed a fudge factor. And okay, we can't accuse Ptolemy too harshly because he wasn't, you know, constrained by our modern scientific method, but Copernicus's theory is in some sense simpler and more elegant because it doesn't require this quick fix to explain why Mercury and Venus always appear close to the sun. The reason why they always appear close to the sun is very simply because they lie inside the Earth's orbit. So fast forwarding a wee bit more, Tycho Brahe was a very famous observer, and he had great patronage from European monarchs, which allowed him to equip his observatory on the island of Hven between Denmark and Sweden with some of the best instruments around. There are still no telescopes yet, but he was able to measure the positions of the planets in the sky to great accuracy. Now, there's lots of famous stories about Tycho Brahe. I'm sure you've probably heard the one about him having a golden nose because he had his nose cut off in a duel. So he was quite a colourful character by the standards of modern day astronomers. He was an excellent observer, very patient, very meticulous, and basically his observations led him to the deduction that Ptolemy's model was wrong, but he wasn't quite sold on Copernicus's either. He came up with a kind of hybrid model whereby you had the Earth and the Moon, and then you had the Sun that was orbited by all the other planets, including a little comet there. So this was a hybrid of an Earth-centred and a Sun-centred system. But Tycho's observations were passed on to Johannes Kepler, who was a very skilled mathematician, and he tried to develop a very complex model, but a rather elegant and beautiful model, whereby the Sun was indeed at the centre, but the orbits of the planets were on spheres, but the size of those spheres was determined by fundamental properties of geometry, the regular solids, the solids that have sides which are with lengths all equal to the same length. For example, a cube, but also the icosahedron, the dodecahedron, and the various others in there. And he dedicated a lot, many years, a lot of his life, to try to make this model work, and he published it in a book, 1596, on the mysteries of the cosmos. It didn't quite work, but nonetheless, it's still a testament to his great sort of tenacity and great patience to try and explore this model. But what helped him to see the inadequacies of that model was the availability of Tycho Brahe's observations. So even back then, there was a very strong link between theory and observations. I think I've got a wee quote here from Kepler. I've written some of the quotes down because I'm not always good at remembering these. Kepler said, "His opinion of Tycho is he is superlatively rich, but he knows not how to make proper use of it, as is the case with most rich people." So for a long time, Tycho Brahe had this great store of observations, and it took some time before Kepler got access to them. But what he came up with as a result of analysis of those observations is what we now regard as the sort of standard picture for the orbits of the planets. They don't follow circles, they don't follow epicycles, instead they follow ellipses, sort of flattened circles with the Sun at one focus. And the key elements of Kepler's model were published in three laws that we call Kepler's laws of motion. The second one of which is what you see illustrated here. It's showing that planets, when they're far away from the Sun, move more slowly. When they're close to the Sun, they move more quickly. A more precise way to express that is that they sweep out triangles of equal area in equal time. So in other words, a planet would take the same time to go from point 1 to 2 as it goes from 7 to 8, because that triangle featuring the arc from 7 to 8 has the same area as that triangle featuring the arc from 1 to 2. So it's about time we started talking about transits, and we're almost there because Kepler is one of the early characters who has something to say about transits. But just before we do that, let me show this little movie which illustrates a few of the points by way of kind of summarising where we've got to so far. So this is a little simulation of the motion of the planets in the centre of our solar system. So we see the Sun at one focus. It's not actually dead centre. You can see Mercury's orbit is in fact rather elliptical. So too is Mars's. We run it again. Then as I was emphasising, the reason why Mercury and Venus appear close to the Sun in the sky can easily be seen because they're inside Earth's orbit. Therefore, you're never going to see Mercury and Venus on the other side of the sky from the Sun, from our point of view. It's because their orbit is inside, just as is observed. And sometimes, as we've seen, the Earth will overtake Mars on the inside lane, causing Mars, from Earth's point of view, to appear to move in a retrograde motion. But our main quest in my talk this morning is to understand how we know how big these ellipses are. how do we set that scale? So, enter the telescope, and in 1582, this painting was done, the spectacle vendor, I think this is supposed to be a market in Amsterdam, and Hans Lippershey, which I probably mispronounced, Lindsay can correct me on that, Hans Lippershey, in 1608, filed a patent for a device for seeing faraway things as though nearby, exploiting this basic technology of spectacles, but using them instead for people to view distant objects. In 1609, the Italian scientist Porta sketched a telescope, at least I'm reliably informed it's a telescope. It's a rather crude drawing, but nonetheless, what that is the precursor to is Galileo the following year, in the autumn winter of 1609-1610, using a telescope, this one in fact, very simple by today's standards, but nonetheless a huge leap forward in the technology available to look at the sky. So Galileo gets a lot of credit for inventing the telescope, but that's wrong, as I'm sure many of you will know. It wasn't that he invented it, but he was really the first astronomer we're aware of to really put it to good use. So among the things Galileo did in the autumn winter of 1609 was to observe the craters of the Moon, the moons of Jupiter, and the phases of Venus. And these helped to drive some nails into the coffin of Ptolemy's theory, because they were very challenging for Ptolemy's theory in many respects. They were in conflict with Aristotle's view that the heavens were perfect and the earth was imperfect, because what we saw was that the moon was an imperfect world with mountains and valleys just like the earth. And Jupiter, well, its moons underwent motion around Jupiter. So that was conflicting with Aristotle's view that all motions had to be around the earth. Now notice, this is the starry messenger, Sidereus Nuncius. I think Edinburgh, the Royal Observatory Edinburgh, they have a copy of this in their library, and it's a very old book. Notice that Galileo was a wee bit unsure about his terminology. On the one hand, he's talking about four planets, and then he calls them the Medician stars, named after the Medici family. But he was certainly quite smart, because he recognised that it was very important to name things after your sponsors, because he got a lot of money from Medici. So that was a seriously damaging piece of evidence for the Ptolemaic view of the universe, and helped the Copernican one, because the moons of Jupiter were orbiting Jupiter. But the real clincher was the phases of Venus. And the idea here goes back again to that diagram we saw before, where in Ptolemy's view, then Venus was orbiting its epicycle, and somehow that line between the Earth and the Sun would move around the Sun, move around the Earth, in the geocentric model, to keep Venus always more or less aligned. Whereas in the heliocentric model, with the Sun at the centre, as we've seen, the reason why Venus appears close to the Sun in the sky is because it's on an orbit inside that of the Earth, but crucially that means that sometimes it will be on the other side of the Sun from us, which would mean it would be fully or almost fully illuminated by the Sun, whereas at other times it would be on our side of the Sun, much larger in size but only partially illuminated as a crescent. So again, as Galileo had the relevant software, he might have made a little movie like this one, which is a simulation of how Venus would have appeared over many months through the autumn of 1609 and the early months of 1610. And sure enough, you see that Venus both changes in size and also changes in phase, entirely consistent with a model with the Earth at not at the centre, but instead the Sun at the centre. This behaviour really seemed impossible to explain in the geocentric model. It seemed pretty clear evidence that the Earth went round the Sun and not the other way around. And interestingly, it's also an early example of people being worried about intellectual property rights, because before Galileo could publish his findings, what he did was he sent a kind of cryptic message on the 1st of January 1610. I can't help but think on the 1st of January he should have had other things to occupy his time. But on the 1st of January he sent a message to the ambassador in Prague, Giuliano de' Medici, again his funding body, and it was this message here: Cynthia figuras emulatur mater amorum. That's the mother of loves imitates the shapes of Cynthia. So I guess maybe he was covering his back here. It meant that if it turned out on more careful analysis of his data that it sure enough did seem to be a strong piece of evidence in favour of the heliocentric model, then this would be him sort of laying his claim that he had been, you know, the first person to observe that. If it turned out that he was wrong, then this would just probably look like the random ramblings of a drunk astronomer on New Year's morning. But nonetheless, it's interesting that he's kind of encoded it as well. It's not got in case the message was intercepted, it's not just a blunt statement, I think I have proved that the Earth goes round the sun. Instead, he's written it in terms of the mother of love, meaning Venus, emulating the phases of the moon, Cynthia being the moon. So anyhow, the main business of what I want to cover is the remainder of the talk, and that's to look at how we have got a hang of the scale of the solar system. So by Galileo's time, we already had a good understanding of how the planets were moving. We'd worked out that the sun was at the centre and not the Earth, but how do we get a scale? Well, we've got the Greeks to thank there as well, because we can do a lot of it using the geometry and trigonometry we learn about at high school. But if you consider this diagram here with the Earth and Venus shown and the Sun, well, you can make a triangle between the position of the Sun, the position of the Earth, and the position of Venus. And at different times, suppose, for example, Venus were here, at different times that triangle will take on a different shape. If instead Venus were round here, then the triangle would be as shown. Therefore, the shape of the triangle changing allows us to exploit certain trigonometric properties, because in particular, when Venus is at its biggest angle away from the Sun, as shown here, this is a right angle triangle. And that means we can use Pythagoras' theorem to establish relationships between the lengths of the sides of that triangle. Or, in fact, really what you're using is the trigonometric relations involving sines and cosines and tangents, if you remember all of that from possibly long ago.
It does,
but the ellipticity of Venus at least is negligible. It certainly would give a small error if you were to apply that to Mercury and to Mars, but you could correct for it as well. But yeah, it does assume circular orbits. So anyhow, based on this sort of application of simple trigonometry, and allowing for, in addition to Mike's comment, you also perhaps have to allow a bit for the orbit being slightly out of the plane of the Earth's orbit too, but you can determine a relative scale, and the mean distance of the Earth from the Sun, if we make that one unit, one astronomical unit as we said at the beginning, then it's possible to establish that the mean distance of Venus from the Sun is about 72% of that, Mercury 39% and so on. But the key question is, how far is the astronomical unit itself? Well, it would be wrong to suggest that we had absolutely no idea, because as long ago as the 3rd and 2nd century BC, there were ideas around attributed to Eratosthenes, although as far as I understand, it's not completely clear that Eratosthenes ever existed as a single person. It could be kind of amalgamation of several people, but Eratosthenes was supposed to be librarian at the Great Library in Alexandria, and had made this sort of rather clever deduction that because there were reports of a well in Syene where on a certain day of the year the sun at midday would be directly overhead, whereas in Alexandria on the same day the sun would produce a shadow of a particular angle, about 1/50th of a full circle, well, Eratosthenes deduced that this meant the Earth was round, and moreover, if one knew the distance from Alexandria to Syene, you could determine the circumference of the Earth. And there's some literature on this where Eratosthenes is claiming that this meant that the circumference of the Earth was about 250,000 stadia. I'm not very sure just how far a stadium was, but nonetheless the principle is perfectly sound. That is using the idea that the sun's rays are coming from so far away that they'll basically be parallel when they reach the Earth, therefore the shadows would behave in just the manner you see in the diagram. Even before that, Aristarchus, who was a Greek astronomer who took a big interest in eclipses, and you'll hear more about eclipses from Lindsay shortly, well, Aristarchus he was able to deduce the distance from the Earth to the Moon from studying the geometry of lunar eclipses. That's where the Moon passes into the Earth's shadow and behind the Earth with the Sun-Earth-Moon alignment. This doesn't happen every month because of the tilt of the Moon's orbit with respect to the Earth's orbital plane. I think Bonnie's going to talk about that sort of thing after lunch. So the idea basically was that if you look at the shadow as it creeps across the Moon, then the curvature of that shadow is related to the size of the Earth, but one can then relate that to the size of the Moon's orbit, just again using sort of simple geometry, and then getting from that to the size of the astronomical unit involves another fairly simple geometrical idea, that if you see the Moon when it's at half illuminated, at half phase, then the angle between the Moon and the Sun at that point again allows you to exploit the properties of right-angled triangles to determine the distance from the Earth to the Sun. And on this basis, which was a perfectly sound method, it was just very hard to measure it precisely, Aristarchus deduced that the Sun was very far away. And therefore, since the Sun was very far away, that meant that it had to be very much larger than the Earth. And on that basis, he was quite keen on the heliocentric model. He thought that that surely meant that the Earth went round the Sun, because it was more natural for the bigger body to be at the centre and the smaller body to go around it. Now that idea was not widely accepted, certainly not by Ptolemy, and indeed for about 1500 years, or no, more like 1800 years thereafter, because we hadn't detected a parallax shift. And the reason that that is the case is because the stars are so far away. So let me explain what a parallax shift is. Remember, the Greek idea was that the Earth went round, well, Aristarchus's idea was that the Earth went round the Sun, but the stars were just fixed to the vault of the heavens, the sphere of fixed stars. The idea of parallax, I'm sure some of you, if you've seen talks by me before, will recognise these slides. We've got these two chaps looking at the treetop and looking at the mountain that it lines up with, and it lines up with a different mountain top because they're looking along a different line of sight. The astronomical equivalent of that is to consider the Earth orbiting the Sun at different times of year, and a relatively nearby star is going to line up with more distant stars. Now, this needn't be a nearby star. It could be a planet, for example, an idea that we'll come back to later as well. Like Mars, for example, would show a parallax shift because it's outside the Earth's orbit. And, well, in January, you would see the star lined up with the stars on the left, hugely exaggerated, whereas in July, the nearby star or planet has moved over towards the stars on the right. Now, this wasn't observed in Greek times. The reason it wasn't observed is because the angles are so small, but quite logically, the Greeks deduced that that meant that the Earth couldn't be moving round the Sun. There was also the rather embarrassing question of, well, if the Earth's moving round the Sun, why don't we all fall off? It took Newton's gravity relay to, I suppose, explain that one. But there were good grounds for believing that the Earth was at the centre in Greek times, despite the fact that Aristarchus had deduced that the Sun was bigger than the Earth using the idea of eclipses. So it was really the mid-19th century before stars' parallax shifts were first determined. And in fact, even the nearest star shows a parallax shift which is only about 1/2000th the width of the full Moon. So it's a tiny, tiny measurement, and therefore extremely hard to reliably determine, certainly with the technology available at the time of Copernicus and so on. But in fact, parallax would be the key to measuring the astronomical unit. So we're now gradually getting round to discuss precisely how we did that. Back to Kepler again. He observed in building his model of the solar system and how the planets' orbits behaved that from time to time Mercury and Venus would line up between the Earth and the Sun. And he predicted that there would be a transit of Mercury on 29th of May 1607. And he thought he'd observed it. But in fact, all he probably discovered were sunspots. He did a little sketch. This is just a later artist's impression. And this is showing several sunspots. So Kepler's observations in 1607, where he thought he was seeing Mercury on the Sun, were probably just sunspots like that. And to demonstrate how easy it is to make that mistake, here's an image from May 7th, 2003, taken at the Science Centre using a sunspotter telescope, and you can see Mercury and about to end its transit of the Sun, but there's a sunspot too. So with a decent telescope you can tell the difference, but Kepler was doing this just using a projected image of the Sun, a kind of pinhole camera. In fact, we think the first person to observe a transit of Mercury was Pierre Gassendi in 7th of November 1631. Now this was predicted by Kepler in 1629, because after he had made his prediction of the 1629 Mercury transit, he got better data on the planet's orbits and then revised his predictions for future transits. Unfortunately, he didn't live to see the one on the 7th of November 1631. But here's Gassendi's little diagram of it. So what you can see is that's the ecliptic is the Earth's orbit projected onto the Sun's disk. And you can see that Mercury's orbit is kind of inclined towards the ecliptic, which is why transits of Mercury are quite rare, because you've got to get the planets and the Sun just lined up exactly. Again, details that I think Bonnie, you'll talk a bit about that. Yeah. So Kepler also predicted a transit of Venus in December 1631, but that was going to happen after sunset in Europe. And well, we've no idea whether anyone, maybe in the North and South America, might have seen it, but certainly no European astronomers could. So the first recorded observation of a transit of Venus by European astronomers was November 24, 1639, Jeremiah Horrocks. And that painting there, known as the founder of English astronomy, it's on display in the Walker Art Gallery, I think that's in Manchester. Certainly this one here, which is another sort of representation of the same event, his friend William Crabtree observed the transit from a nearby location. And that image, that painting is in Manchester Town Hall. Horrocks was very young at the time, as you can see, he died when he was only 22. He went to university when he was 13? Yep, just make sure I got that right. Went to Emmanuel College in Cambridge at 13. It was known by his classmates as the Curious Astronomer, and his Venus transit observations were published in 1664 to the Royal Society, and this is the drawing that he made. So he's showing again the path of the Earth's orbit projected onto the Sun, and there's his drawing of where Venus was crossing the Sun's disk, and as it made its way across the disk, he made subsequent drawings, and the 1, 2, 3 denote the time when that was observed. So, we're now getting to the nitty-gritty, because now the professional astronomers were getting seriously interested in the potential of transits. And that really got going in 1677, when Edmund Halley travelled to St Helena to map the southern skies. He observed the transit of Mercury on November 7th, and he realised that there was the potential, if these observations could be made at several points on the Earth, many points on the Earth, to exploit the observations to measure the distance from the Earth to the Sun. Sorry. The principle behind that is fairly simple. It's just our old parallax idea again. If you can observe a transit of Venus from two different locations on the Earth, say A and B as shown, then Venus will appear to follow a slightly different path across the Sun. And if you know the distance from A to B, then you can use your knowledge of triangles to work out the distance from the Earth to the Sun. Of course, you don't need to know the distance from A to B. Fortunately, around the same time, 1669, Jean Picard, not Jean-Luc Picard, I hasten to add, but Jean Picard, he measured the distance from Malvoisin to Amiens. Amiens north of Paris, I think. And he was able to determine that just by, you know, surveying techniques, was able to measure the longitude at both locations, but then also to determine the actual physical distance around the circumference of the Earth. And that allowed him to deduce a radius of the Earth of 6365 kilometres, which is only about 0.2% in error compared with modern values. So all the pieces were kind of in place to now use observations of a transit to measure the distance from the Earth to the Sun. And in 1716, Edmund Halley presented a paper to the Royal Society appealing to astronomers to use the opportunity of forthcoming Venus transits in 1761 and 1769 to try and do this. And I know time's a wee bit against us, but it's worth just reading how he wrote this, because it's so different from the language that astronomers use nowadays. This is part of his address to the Royal Society. I recommend it, therefore, again and again to those curious astronomers who, when I am dead, will have the opportunity of observing these things, that they would remember this my admonition and diligently apply themselves with all their might to the making of this observation. And I earnestly wish them all imaginable success. In the first place, that they may not, by the unseasonable obscurity of a cloudy sky, be deprived of this most desirable sight. And then that, having ascertained with more exactness the magnitudes of the planetary orbits, it may redound to their eternal fame and glory. And I imagine Lindsay and Bonnie would concur with me that that's the reason why we do astronomy, is so that it will redound to our eternal fame and glory. To say it's language that you don't quite meet these days, but very grand stuff. Yes, we're still waiting. The serious point, I think, though, about that is that notice he said, when I am dead. And, you know, it's quite a profound thought to think that he was so enthusiastic, even in the early 1700s, to carry out this long-term project over many decades, planning ahead for it, making it a sort of worldwide endeavour involving cooperation between astronomers across the globe. That's something that we think maybe more about as modern-day astronomy and astrophysics, projects that will take decades to complete, but there was, you know, evidence of it even back then. And Halley wasn't necessarily in it for his own personal glory. He recognised that the people who would carry out the observations would not be him, because he wouldn't be alive, but his job was to try and make sure that future generations of astronomers were prepared to do it. Fortunately, they were, and indeed what helped to convince astronomers and governments and so on was that Halley predicted that the astronomical unit could be measured to about 1 part in 500, provided you timed the eclipse accurately, the transit accurately enough, and you knew the distance between the different points on the Earth. So, 1761, 6th of June, much planning for many years, even things like public talks on it, including ones by a quite famous Scottish scientist called James Ferguson, who got quite a reputation for being able to explain all this complicated trigonometry and geometry to the general public. Unfortunately, there were various wars going on and the like, but even despite there being a war between France and Britain, the astronomers still managed to cooperate at that time to coordinate their observations. And there were something like 120 astronomers scattered around the globe, 60 different locations, who were trying to observe this transit of Venus. The results were rather poor, though. There was bad weather, which blighted many of the locations. Some regions of the globe that weren't terribly well covered, there wasn't all that much in the southern hemisphere, for example. A kind of optical illusion effect known as the black drop effect, which made it very hard to time the exact moment when Venus would cross inside the Sun's disk, or would leave the Sun's disk. And we can talk more about this later, but the black drop effect, a good way to illustrate this is if you try and take a photograph of you holding your finger and thumb together against a very bright background, as you prise your finger and thumb apart, then it sort of looks as if somehow you've managed to grow a little extension between the two. And then you see the same one there. So that's a systematic error in the blight of any scientific measurements, because no matter how often you repeat the observations, it's hard to make that error go away unless you're very careful. But nonetheless, the results weren't bad, not nearly as good as Halley had predicted, but looking at all the results, the astronomical unit was coming in somewhere between 77 and 97 million miles, but a 20% uncertainty. So the hope was that things would be better next time round in 1769, and Neville Maskelyne, who was Astronomer Royal then, he said, "I'm afraid we must wait until the next transit in 1769 before astronomers will be able to do justice to Dr. Halley's noble proposal." And that's where Captain Cook comes in, because his second great voyage of discovery included a stop in Tahiti, and that was to carry out observations of the transit of Venus with the astronomer Charles Green on board. Now he, depending on your point of view, either had got lucky or had been in some sense demoted, because he was stuck in London at Regent's Park for the first one in 1769, but then he got the chance to go on Cook's voyage and to make the observations from Tahiti for 1769. Sadly he died though. It was a long voyage, of course, didn't die during the observations, but he subsequently died, I think it was of typhoid. But anyhow, Cook had on board, I'm not sure if it was one of Harrison's original H4s, but if you know the longitude book and the story of that, the difficulty in making accurate timing measurements at sea, well, they were going to Tahiti, but they still had to get there first, and obviously they had to get there for the day of the eclipse. So having reliable clocks on board was important, not just for the transit observations themselves, but also for navigation. And, well, they arrived in Tahiti on the 13th of April 1769. They constructed a fort to protect all this equipment from the natives, and an observatory at a location that is still today known as Point Venus. And here are the drawings of Cook and Charles Green drawing their observations of Venus as it sort of crossed the limb of the sun and observed in projection through their telescope. And here's just a little movie where I've simulated how Venus would have tracked across the sun. It would have taken about 6 hours in total from the first crossing of the sun's disk to the exit. And so they were just observing for a few minutes at the crucial time when Venus was entering and leaving, and having to record the time when that happened. No, it was malaria. I thought I would have it on the slide. So the Endeavour explored for 2 more years. It returned to Britain. I think its first landfall was in fact in the Orkney Islands, back in Britain. But during the return voyage, Charles Green passed away from malaria. There was another French astronomer around the same time who was carrying out observations. The 1769 transit, he was dispatched off to Baja California, close to the Mexican border, and he died of typhus just a few months later. But I'm afraid the award for the unluckiest astronomer doesn't go to one of those, much as you might think it would, because probably Guillaume Joseph Hyacinthe Jean-Baptiste Le Gentil, he suffered a kind of fate worse than death, you might say. First of all, he went off to Pondicherry in India for the 1761 transit. But after 4 months, he reached L'Île de France, nowadays we refer to as Mauritius, to learn that Pondicherry was surrounded by British forces. So he couldn't get there. He managed to hitch a ride in a troop ship, and that was bound for Pondicherry, but he got delayed by storms, and then he learned eventually on March 20th that the British had taken Pondicherry, so the troop ship turned around and went back, and they weren't interested in the fact that he wanted to see this transit. So having failed to see anything for the 1761 transit, he decided he would stay in the South Seas, and he, I don't quite know what he did for the 8 years, but he decided he would observe the 1769 transit. On that occasion he decided to go to Manila, but then was persuaded by Pierre Lalonde, another French astronomer, to try Pondicherry again. But there was a storm all day on the 3rd of June 1769, and it ended just a few minutes before the transit ended, and then it was beautiful clear skies for the rest of the day. And he's got this really sad sort of, you know, lament of his bad luck. He said, "That is the fate which often attends astronomers. I had travelled around 10,000 leagues. I seemed to have traversed such a great expanse of seas, exiling myself from my motherland, only to be the spectator of a fatal cloud which arrived in front of the sun at the precise moment of my observation, snatching from me the fruit of my efforts and exertions." So he was very upset about that. To make it worse, when he got back to France, he discovered that his family had sort of presumed him dead and had disinherited him. So he'd sold all his possessions. But it's got a kind of happy ending, because I understand that some years later he married a rich heiress and lived out the remainder of his life in wealth and happiness. So there were observations going on all around the world. Another sort of quirky example was this one. Vardo in Lapland, the observations there were being made at the same time as in Tahiti and elsewhere. Rather similar track for Venus across the sun, but the timings were slightly different. Now these observations were made by the wonderfully named Father Maximilian Hell, who was a Jesuit astronomer, and when the Royal Society were collating everyone's observations, poor Father Hell, he got sort of discredited for a long time. People just assumed, well, on a first pass through the observations, it was assumed that he must have just got the timings completely wrong. But what had not been accounted for was the fact that because this was June, basically the sun was above the horizon all the time, and therefore he was looking essentially from the other side of the earth compared with Tahiti, and that resulted in another systematic error. So it appears as if his observations were broadly correct, so that had to be accounted for too. And that's just a couple of slides. I'll race through these because time's against me, just to show that when Vardo, when Venus is just touching the Sun, I've just simulated these at 2034 Greenwich Mean Time, then at the same time in Tahiti, Venus hasn't quite started yet. So as I say, the timings were different, and likewise the others. Let's say time's a bit against us. So the 1769 transit was also observed by King George III, no less, who was a very keen amateur astronomer. I'm not sure whether his results made it into the final Royal Society calculation. And then, well, those calculations were analysed by Thomas Hornsby, who was civilian professor of natural philosophy, what we now call physics, at Oxford. And here's a quotation from him, rather dry and dull, you know, British academic way of putting it. "From the observations made in different parts by the astronomers of different nations, and especially from those made under the patronage and direction of the Royal Society, the learned of the present time may congratulate themselves in obtaining as accurate a determination of the Sun's distance as perhaps the nature of the subject will permit." Cassini de Thoulis, on the other hand, representing the French observers, was a wee bit more effusive about it. He said, "Happy is our century, to which has been reserved the glory of being witness to an event which will render it memorable in the annals of the sciences." Now, I'm running a wee bit behind. What I had thought I might do is just... Lindsay, can I take another couple of minutes? Yep. It's just to tell you a bit about what happened next, so to speak. Because this was a pretty reliable determination of the distance from the Earth to the Sun, but by no means the definitive value that we would now use today. And this, after all, was 1769, and there's a lot of progress been made since. So just to briefly tell you about that, in the 19th century... Rather than focusing on the transit of Venus, attention switched to Mars, to use the parallax of Mars instead to determine the astronomical unit. The principle's the same, it's our old parallax effect again. If you can view Mars from several locations against the background stars, you can use trigonometry to determine the distance. You're making the observations at night, which in some ways is easier. Mars is smaller in size, so there's a smaller error in where Mars ends and the background sky begins. There's no black drop effect to worry about, this illusionary effect where a very dark source is against a very bright background. And the observations of Mars, well, this is just to show the same effect for the Moon. This is a simulated view of the Moon on the equator, 0 degrees north, 0 degrees west. And there's the Moon at the same time from the other side of the Earth, 180 degrees west. So notice that the Moon moves against the background stars. Now, Mars is so far away that the measurements can't be seen easily to the naked eye, but it's the same principle. And David Gill, who was an astronomer at the Royal Observatory in Edinburgh around that time, he was dispatched off to Ascension Island in the Atlantic, the South Atlantic, to observe Mars in 1877. And there's Mars Bay, still so named, on Ascension Island, is where he did his observations. And that improved the answer yet further to between 92,981,000 and 93,235,600. So there were photographic observations of the transit of Venus in 1874 and 1882, but they were no longer really competitive with this as a method for determining the distance. So Mars was now firmly in the frame. But then Venus kind of got a bit of a look in again, if I'm allowed to stretch a point here, because the near-Earth asteroid Eros, you know, god of love, related to Venus in that vague sense, was used, again using parallax, but because Eros was closer to the Earth, the parallax shift was greater, therefore you could determine the distance from the Earth to the Sun more precisely. And astronomer Royal Harold Spencer Jones had a lot to do with that. That was one of his big areas of work, was using parallax observations of Eros to determine the astronomical unit. You're now down to about 0.1 uncertainty, 0.1% rather, in the astronomical unit. And then finally, in 1968, very famous American physicist Irwin Shapiro used radar echoes bounced off Venus, so Venus is back in the frame again, to determine not only a definitive astronomical unit, which was adopted in 1976 by the International Astronomical Union, which is the figure you see there, But Shapiro's observations also demonstrated a time delay as the radar was passing close to the sun, because time runs more slowly in a strong gravitational field. So therefore, what you were seeing was both a fundamental test of the scale of the solar system, this problem that had vexed astronomers for many centuries before, but also a much more modern challenge, which was to understand the curvature of space and time. So that's us basically done. Let me finish with 2 minutes just on the 2004 transit of Venus, just to bring it up to date then. This is the track that one saw. I managed to see it for a brief time from the island of Skye, where mercifully it was clear. And these are some images from Italy, where no doubt it was clear the whole time, and you can see it ran for about 6 hours in total. And you can see evidence again of this parallax effect at work. I'm just going to briefly show you observations made of the 2004 eclipse in Helsinki and in Faro in Portugal, distance of 3,500 or so kilometres apart. And this is just a little animated GIF that I found from some observers in Finland who put this together, and you can see at the same time where Venus was at a particular location in Helsinki, just crossing the disk, then it was in a slightly different place in Faro. And that's the key idea that lets you get the distance from the Earth to the Sun. So 2012, the transit of Venus is going to be visible on June the 6th, but not really from Britain. It will be visible partly from Britain, but if you really want to see it, then the best place is somewhere out in the middle of the Pacific. So if I were you, I would book your hotel in Hawaii about now. Okay, thank you very much. Since I've taken longer than planned, it might be best if we have a few minutes if people want to, you know, go use the toilet or whatever as we swap over the talks. But perhaps if there are questions, we could save them for after Lindsay's talk, so that I don't eat into Lindsay's talk any further. And we'll be around at lunch as well, so if you want to chat to us then, there'll be plenty of chance. Okay, thank you.